so many dings, and she'd seen her phone screen update so many times, that she couldn't wait. "Okay, I can't stand it anymore. I posted that photo I took of your chandelier, Mercer, and people love it." She beamed and raised her glass. "That's what we should toast." Mercer didn't look amused.
"Wait, you posted them where?"
"That's great, Mercer,"
her father said, and raised his own glass. Mercer's glass was not raised.
"Where'd you post them, May?"
"Everywhere relevant," she said. "And the comments are amazing." She searched her screen. "Just let me read the first one. And I quote, 'Wow, that is gorgeous.' That's from a pretty well-known industrial designer in Stockholm. Here's another one. 'Very cool. Reminds me of something I saw in Barcelona last year.' That was from a designer in Santa Fe who has her own shop. She gave your thing 3 out of 4 stars and had some suggestions about how you might improve it. I bet you could sell them there if you wanted to. So here's another." Mercer had his palms on the table.
"Stop, please."
"Why? You haven't even heard the best part. On Design Mind, you already have 122 smiles. That's an incredible amount to get so quickly. And they have a ranking there, and you're in the top 50 for today. Actually, I know how you could raise that." At the same time, it occurred to May that this kind of activity would surely get her party rank into the 1800s, and if she could get enough of these people to buy the work, it would mean solid conversion and retail raw numbers.
"May, stop. Please stop."
Mercer was staring at her, his eyes small and round.
"I don't want to get loud here in your parents' home, but either you stop or I have to walk out."
"Just hold on a sec," she said, and scrolled through her messages, looking for one that she was sure would impress him. She'd seen a message come in from Dubai, and if she found it, she knew his resistance would fall away.
"May," she heard her mother say.
"May." But May couldn't locate the message. Where was it? While she scrolled, she heard the scraping of a chair, but she was so close to finding it that she didn't look up. When she did, she found Mercer gone and her parents staring at her.
"I think it's nice you want to support Mercer," her mother said. "But I just don't understand why you do this now. We're trying to enjoy a nice dinner."
May stared at her mother, absorbing all the disappointment and bewilderment that she could stand, then ran outside and reached Mercer as he was backing out of the driveway. She got into the passenger seat.
"Stop."
His eyes were dull, lifeless. He put the car in park and rested his hands in his lap, exhaling with all the condescension he could muster.
"What the hell is your problem, Mercer?"
"May, I asked you to stop, and you didn't."
"Did I hurt your feelings?"
"No, you hurt my brain. You make me think you're batshit crazy. I asked you to stop, and you wouldn't."
"I wouldn't stop trying to help you."
"I didn't ask for your help, and I didn't give you permission to post a photo of my work."
"Your work?"
She heard something barbed in her voice that she knew wasn't right or productive.
"You're snide, May. And you're mean, and you're callous."
"What?"
"I'm the opposite of callous, Mercer. I'm trying to help you because I believe in what you do."
"No, you don't.
May, you're just unable to allow anything to live inside a room. My work exists in one room. It doesn't exist anywhere else, and that's how I intend it."
"So you don't want business?"
Mercer looked through his windshield, then leaned back.
"May, I've never felt more that there is some cult taking over the world. You know what someone tried to sell me the other day? Actually, I bet it's somehow affiliated with the Circle. Have you heard of Homey? The thing where your phone scans your house for the barcodes of every product?
Right, then it orders new stuff whenever you're getting low. It's brilliant."
"You think this is okay?"
Mercer said.
"You know how they framed it for me? It's a usual utopian vision. This time, they were saying it'll reduce waste. If stores know what their customers want, then they don't overproduce, don't overship, don't have to throw stuff away when it's not bought. I mean, like everything else you guys are pushing, it sounds perfect, sounds progressive, but it carries with it more control, more central tracking of everything we do."
"Mercer, the Circle is a group of people like me.
Are you saying that somehow we're all in a room somewhere watching you, planning world domination?"
"No, first of all, I know it's all people like you, and that's what's so scary. Individually, you don't know what you're doing collectively. But secondly, don't presume the benevolence of your leaders.
For years, there was this happy time when those controlling the major internet conduits were actually decent enough people, or at least they weren't predatory and vengeful. But I always worried, what if someone was willing to use this power to punish those who challenged them?
What are you saying?
You think it's just a coincidence that every time some congresswoman or blogger talks about monopoly, they suddenly become ensnared in some terrible sex porn witchcraft controversy? For 20 years, the internet was capable of ruining anyone in minutes. But not until your three wise men, or at least one of them, was anyone willing to do it. You're saying this is news to you? You're so paranoid. Your conspiracy theory brain always depressed me, Mercer. You sound so ignorant. In saying that Homey is some scary new thing, I mean, for 100 years, there were milkmen who brought you milk. They knew when you needed it. There were butchers who sold you meat, bakers who would drop off bread, but the milkman wasn't scanning my house. I mean, anything with a UPC code can be scanned. Already, millions of people's phones are scanning their homes and communicating all that information out to the world. And so what? You don't want Charmin to know how much of their toilet paper you're using? Is Charmin oppressing you in some significant way? No, mate, it's different. That would be easier to understand. Here, though, there are no oppressors. No one's forcing you to do this. You willingly tie yourself to these leashes, and you willingly become utterly socially autistic. You no longer pick up on basic human communication clues. You're at a table with three humans, all of whom are looking at you and trying to talk to you, and you're staring at a screen, searching for strangers in Dubai.
You're not so pure, Mercer. You have an email account. You have a website.
Here's the thing, and it's painful to say this to you, but you're not very interesting anymore. You sit at a desk 12 hours a day, and you have nothing to show for it except for some numbers that won't exist or be remembered in a week. You're leaving no evidence that you lived. There's no proof.
Fuck you, Mercer.
And worse, you're not doing anything interesting anymore. You're not seeing anything, saying anything. The weird paradox is that you think you're at the center of things, and that makes your opinions more valuable. But you yourself are becoming less vibrant. I bet you haven't done anything off-screen in months, have you?
You're such a fucker, Mercer.
Do you go outside anymore?
You're the interesting one, is that it? The idiot who makes chandeliers out of dead animal parts? You're the wonder boy of all that's fascinating?
You know what I think, May? I think you think that sitting at your desk, frowning and smiling, somehow makes you think you're actually living some fascinating life. You comment on things, and that substitutes for doing them. You look at pictures of Nepal, push a smile button, and you think that's the same as going there. I mean, what would happen if you actually went? Your circle jerk ratings or whatever the fuck would drop below an acceptable level? May, do you realize how incredibly boring you've become? For many years now, Mercer had been the human she'd loathed more than any other. This was not new. He'd always had the unique ability to send her into apoplexy, his professional smugness, his antiquarian bullshit, and most of all, his baseline assumption, so wrong, that he knew her. He knew the parts of her he liked and agreed with, and he pretended those were her true self, her essence. He knew nothing. But with every passing mile as she drove home, she felt better. Better with every mile between her and that fat fuck. The fact that she'd ever slept with him made her physically sick. Had she been possessed by some weird demon? Her body must have been overtaken for those 3 years by some terrible force that blinded her to his wretchedness. He'd been fat even then, hadn't he? What kind of guy is fat in high school? He's talking to me about sitting behind a desk when he's 40 pounds overweight? The man was upside down. She would not talk to him again. She knew this, and there was comfort in that. Relief spread over her like warm water. She would never talk to him, write to him. She would insist that her parents sever any connection to him. She planned to destroy the chandelier, too. It would look like an accident. Maybe stage a break-in? May laughed to herself, thinking of exorcising that fat idiot from her life, that ugly, ever-sweating moose man who would never have a say in her world again. She saw the sign for Maiden's Voyages and thought nothing of it. She passed the exit and didn't feel a thing. Seconds later, though, she was leaving the highway and doubling back toward the beach. It was almost 10 o'clock, so she knew the shop had been closed for hours. So what was she doing? She wasn't reacting to Mercer's bullshit questions about what she was or wasn't doing outside. She was only seeing if the place was open. She knew it wouldn't be, but maybe Marion was there and maybe she'd let May take one out for half an hour. She lived in the trailer next door, after all. Maybe May could catch her walking within the compound and be able to persuade her to rent her one. May parked and peered through the chain-link fence, seeing no one, only the shuttered rental kiosk,
the rows of kayaks and paddle boards. She stood, hoping to see a silhouette within the trailer, but there was none. The light within was dim, rose-colored, the trailer empty. She walked to the tiny beach and stood, watching the moonlight play on the still surface of the bay. She sat. She didn't want to go home, though there was no point in staying. Her head was full of Mercer and his giant infant's face and all the bullshit things he had said that night, and said every night. That would be, she was certain, the last time she tried to help him in any way. He was in her past, in the past. He was an antique, a dull, inanimate object she could leave in an attic. She stood up, thinking she should go back to work on her party rank, when she saw something odd. Against the far side of the fence, outside the enclosure, she saw a large object leaning precariously. It was either a kayak or a paddleboard, and she quickly made her way to it. It was a kayak, she realized, and it was resting on the free side of the fence, a paddle next to it. The positioning of the kayak made little sense. She'd never seen one standing nearly upright before and was sure that Marion wouldn't have approved. May could only think that someone had brought a rental back after closing and tried to get it as close to the enclosure as possible. May thought at the very least she should bring the kayak to the ground to reduce the chances that it would fall overnight. She did so, carefully lowering it to the sand, surprised by how light it was. Then she had a thought. The water was just 30 yards away, and she knew that she could easily drag it to shore. Would it be theft to borrow a kayak that had already been borrowed? She wasn't lifting it over the fence, after all. She was only extending the borrowing that someone else had extended. She would return it in an hour or two, and no one would know the difference. May put the paddle inside and dragged the kayak across the sand for a few feet, testing the feeling of this act. Was it theft? Certainly Marion would understand if she knew. Marion was a free spirit, not a rule-bound shrew, and seemed like the type of person who, in May's shoes, would do the same thing. She would not like the liability implications, but then again, were there such implications? How could Marion be held accountable if the kayak was taken without her knowledge? Now May was at the shore, and the bow of the kayak was wet. And then, feeling the water under the vessel, the way the current seemed to pull the kayak out from her and into the fuller volume of the bay, May knew that she would do this. The one complication was that she wouldn't have a life preserver. It was the one thing the borrower managed to heave over the fence, but the water was so calm that May saw no possibility of real danger if she stayed close to the shore. Once she was out on the water, though, feeling the heavy glass under her, the quick progress she was making, she thought she might not stay in the shallows, that this would be the night to make it to Blue Island. Angel Island was easy, people went there all the time, but Blue Island was strange, jagged, never visited. May smiled, picturing herself there, and smiled wider, thinking of Mercer, his smug face, surprised, upended. Mercer would be too fat to fit into a kayak, she thought, and too lazy to make it out of the marina. A man, fast approaching 30, making antler chandeliers and lecturing her? Who worked at the Circle? About life paths? This was a joke. But May, who was in the T2K and who was moving quickly up through the ranks, was also brave, capable of taking a kayak in the night into the Blackwater Bay to explore an island Mercer would only view through a telescope, sitting on his potato sack ass, painting animal parts with silver paint. Hers was not an itinerary rooted in any logic. She had no idea of the currents deeper in the bay, or of the wisdom in getting so close to the tankers that used the nearby shipping lane, especially given she would be in the dark, invisible to them. And by the time she reached or got close to the island, the conditions might be too rough for her to go back. But driven by a force within her as strong and reflexive as sleep, she knew she would not stop until she made it to Blue Island, or was somehow prevented from doing so. If the wind kept quiet and the water held steady, she would make it there. As she paddled beyond the sailboats and breakers, she looked south, squinting in search of the barge where the woman and man lived. But the shapes that far away were not clear, and anyway, they were unlikely to have lights on this late. She stayed on course, cutting quickly beyond the anchored yachts and into the round stomach of the bay. She heard a quick splash behind her and turned to find the black head of a harbor seal, not 15 feet away. She waited for him to drop below the surface, but he stayed, staring at her. She turned back and paddled again toward the island, and the seal followed her for a bit as if also wanting to see what she wanted to see. May wondered, briefly, if the seal would follow her all the way, or if he was, perhaps, on his way to the group of rocks near the island, where many times, driving on the bridge overhead, she'd seen seals sunning. But the next time she turned around, the animal was gone. The water's surface remained calm, even as she ventured deeper. Where it usually turned rough, where the water was exposed to ocean winds, it was, this night, utterly placid, and her progress remained swift. In 20 minutes, she was halfway to the island, or it appeared that way. The distances were impossible to tell, especially at night, but the island was growing in her vision, and features of the rock she'd never grasped before were now visible. She saw something reflective at the top, the moonlight casting it in bright silver. She saw the remains of what she was sure was a window resting on the black sand of the shore. Far away, she heard a foghorn coming from the mouth of the Golden Gate. The fog must be thick there, she thought. Even while where she was, only a few miles away, the night was clear, the moon brilliant and nearly whole. Its shimmer on the water was outlandish, so bright she found herself squinting. She wondered about the rocks near the island where she'd seen seals and sea lions. Would they be there? And would they flee before her arrival? A breeze came from the west, a Pacific wind swooping down off the hills, and she sat still for a moment, measuring it. If it picked up, she would have to turn back. She was now closer to the island than the shore, but if the water grew choppy, the danger, alone and without a life preserver, sitting atop a kayak, would be untenable. But as quickly as it had come, the wind disappeared. A loud murmuring sound brought her attention to the north. A boat, something like a tug, was coming toward her. On the roof of the cabin, she saw lights, white and red, and knew it was a patrol of some kind, Coast Guard probably, and they were close enough to see her. If she remained upright, her silhouette would quickly give her away. She flattened herself against the floor of the kayak, hoping that if they saw the shape she was making, they would assume it was a rock, a log, a seal, or simply a wide black ripple interrupting the bay's silver shimmer. The groan of the boat's engine grew louder, and May was sure there would soon be some bright flood upon her. But the boat passed quickly, and May went unseen. The last push to the island was so quick, May questioned her sense of distance. One moment she felt she was halfway there at best, and the next she was racing toward the island's beach as if propelled by heavy tailwinds. She jumped from the bow, the water white cold and seizing her. She rushed to get the kayak on shore, dragging it up until it was entirely out of the water and onto the sand. Remembering the time when a quickly rising tide nearly took her vessel away, she turned it parallel to the shore and placed large stones on either side. She stood, breathing heavily, feeling strong, feeling enormous. What a strange thing, she thought, to be here. There was a bridge nearby, and while driving over it, she'd seen this island 100 times and had never seen a soul, human or animal. No one dared or bothered. What was it about her that made her this curious? It occurred to her that this was the only, or at least the best, way to come here. Marion would not have wanted her to go this far and might have sent a speedboat to find her and bring her back. And the Coast Guard, didn't they routinely dissuade people from coming here? Was it a private island? All of these questions and concerns were irrelevant now because it was dark, no one could see her, and no one would ever know she was here. But she would know. She walked the perimeter. The beach collared most of the southern side of the island, then gave way to a sheer cliff. She looked up, seeing no footholds, and below was the frothy shore, so she returned the way she came, finding the hillside rough and rocky, and the shore largely unremarkable. There was a thick stripe of seaweed with crab shells and flotsam embedded, and she threaded her fingers through it. The moonlight gave the seaweed some of the phosphorescence she'd seen before, adding a rainbow sheen, as if lit from within. For a brief moment, she felt like she was on some body of water on the moon itself, everything cast in a strange, inverted palette. What should have been green looked gray. What should have been blue was silver. Everything she was seeing, she'd never seen before. And just as she had this thought, out of the corner of her eye, dropping over the Pacific, she saw what she was sure was a shooting star. She'd only seen one before, and couldn't be sure what she saw was the same thing, an arc of light disappearing behind the black hills.
But what else could it be? She sat for a moment on the beach, staring into the same spot where she'd seen it, as if there might be another, or that it